open a book and it invites you to fall in.
That was my North Star. I always sailed towards that star.
And so the project grew out of trying to understand who that devil was, but also trying to address my own ignorance.
Welcome to the National Writer Series from Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Doug Stanton. Author David Grand says his new book started as a traditional crime investigation into the murders of Osage Indians in the 1920s.
But as I did more research in archives, as I spoke to more Osage, I began to realize that that was really a mistaken notion. This was not a story about who did it, but who didn't do it, and about a much broader conspiracy, much darker conspiracy, in which evil lurked in the hearts of many seemingly ordinary citizens.
David Grand is a New Yorker magazine staff writer and author of The Lost City of Z. His new book is called Killers of the Flower Moon. David talks this hour with editor and publisher Lucas Whitman. Lucas asked David to tell him more about his new book.
It's about the Osage Indians of Oklahoma, who in the early parts of the 20th century had become the wealthiest people in the world because of oil under their land. And then they began to be serially murdered in one of the most sinister crimes in American history. And the case would go on to become one of the FBI's first major homicide cases. And I thought I would just read you a very short section from the beginning of the book, just a few paragraphs. And for those of you, what you need to, the only parts you really need to know is the setting is Oklahoma. And one of the families that is being targeted is a woman named Molly Burkhart, an Osage Indian. And at this point, two Osage Indians have mysteriously disappeared. One of them was Molly's older sister, Anna, and another was an Osage named Charles Whitehorn. A week after Anna, that's Molly's sister, disappeared, an oil worker was on a hill a mile north of downtown Bahuska when he noticed something poking out of the brush near the base of a derrick. The worker came closer. Was a rotting corpse. Between the eyes were two bullet holes. The victim had been shot, execution style. It was hot and wet and loud on the hillside. Drills shook the earth as they bore through the limestone sediment. Derrick swung their large clawing arms back and forth. Other people gathered around the body, which was so badly decomposed that it was impossible to identify. One of the pockets held a letter. Someone pulled it out, straightening the paper, and read it. The letter was addressed to Charles Whitehorn, and that's how they first knew it was him. Around the same time, a man was squirrel hunting by Three Mile Creek near Fairfax with his teenage son and a friend. While the two men were getting a drink of water from a creek, the boy spotted a squirrel and pulled the trigger. There was a burst of heat and light, and the boy watched as the squirrel was hit and began to tumble lifelessly over the edge of the ravine. He chased after it, making his way down a steep wooded slope and into a gulch where the air was thicker and where he could hear the murmuring of the creek. He found the squirrel and picked it up. Then he screamed, "Oh, Papa." By the time his father reached him, the boy had crawled onto a rock. He gestured toward the mossy edge of the creek and said, "A dead person." There was the bloated and decomposing body of what appeared to be an American Indian woman. She was on her back with her hair twisted in the mud and her vacant eyes facing the sky. The men and the boy hurried out of the ravine and raced on their horse-drawn wagon through the prairie, dust swirling around them. When they reached Fairfax Main Street, they couldn't find any lawmen, so they stopped at the Big Hill Trading Company, a large general store that had an undertaking business as well. They told the proprietor, Scott Mathis, what had happened, and he alerted his undertaker, who went with several men to the creek. There they rolled the body onto a wagon seat and with a rope dragged it to the top of the ravine, then laid it inside a wooden box in the shade of a blackjack tree. When the undertaker covered the bloated corpse with salt and water, it began to shrink as if the last bit of life was leaking out. The undertaker tried to determine if the woman was Anna Brown, whom he'd known. He and the undertaker, however, couldn't make an identification. But Mathis, who managed Anna's financial affairs, contacted Molly, her sister Molly Burkhart, and she led a grim procession toward the creek that included Ernest, that's Molly's husband, Molly's sister, her younger sister Rita, and Rita's husband, Bill Smith. Molly and Rita arrived and stepped close to the body. The stench was overwhelming. Vultures circled obscenely in the sky. It was hard for Molly and Rita to discern that the face was Anna's. There was virtually nothing left of it. But they recognized her Indian blanket and the clothes that Molly had washed for her. Then Rita's husband, Bill, took a stick and pried open her mouth, and they could see Anna's gold fillings. "That is sure enough Anna," Bill said. Rita began to weep, and her husband led her away. Eventually, Molly mouthed the word yes. It was Anna. Molly was the one in the family who always maintained her composure, and she now retreated from the creek with Ernest, leaving behind the first hint of the darkness that threatened to destroy not only her family, but her tribe.
So tell us a little bit, let's set a little bit more of the scene there. Who were the Osage? Why had they ended up in this little corner of Oklahoma, and sort of what was their history?
Yeah, so the Osage had once laid claim to the central part of the country, an area that stretched all the way from Kansas and Missouri to the edge of the Rockies. Thomas Jefferson referred to them as the Great Nation. And in 1804, he actually met with a delegation of Osage chiefs in the White House, and he assured them that they would know the federal government only as friends and benefactors, and of course, within a very short time, began to drive them off their lands. And within just a few decades, the Osage were forced to cede more than 100 million acres of their ancestral lands. And they were eventually confined to a reservation in Kansas in the 1860s, where once more they were under siege by white settlers. And they were forced once again to look for a new homeland. And it was then that this Osage chief stood up. I actually found the record. You can find his statement, and I'll paraphrase it. But he essentially said, we should move to this area that was then an Indian territory. It would later become part of the state of Oklahoma. And he said because the land was rocky and hilly and infertile, and the white man considered it worthless, and so they would finally leave us alone, and my people will be happy there. And so they migrated there. They actually bought the land. They had a deed to it. They paid 70 cents per acre. And by then, the forced migrations had a tremendous toll on the tribe. The numbers had dwindled to just a few thousand. But they settled in this area that was vast but impoverished. And then lo and behold, that land turned out to be sitting upon some of the largest oil deposits then in the United States. And gradually, the Osage, by the 20s, were fabulously wealthy.
When the oil was discovered in the 1890s? Roughly?
So it was interesting, and not to get too arcane, but there is a really interesting backstory to how the Osage got their mineral wealth. Like many other American Indian nations, the U.S. government forced upon the Osage the very brutal culmination of their assimilation campaign, which was called allotment. An allotment essentially was a way to end the communal ownership of land, and then it was divvied up into parcels. Native Americans were given a parcel, each of them, to become private property owners, and then the rest of the land would be open to settlers. When the Osage
To white settlers.
To white settlers, yes, which was not coincidental. It was the intention to make it much easier to procure their land. But when the Osage were negotiating their treaty over allotment, they had more leverage than a lot of other American Indian nations. Partly they had a deed to their land. They were also the last. They had been resisting allotment for years, so there was a rush to make Oklahoma a state, and they were the last of the American Indian nations in Indian territory to be allotted. They were also led at the time by one of the greatest chiefs, a guy who spoke seven languages, including Latin, French, and Sioux. And they inserted into their treaty provision a provision that at the time seemed very curious, which it said, we shall maintain all the subsurface mineral rights to our land. Now, to your question, they had some hints that there was at least some oil, but nobody thought they were sitting upon a fortune.
Right, there had been one man who had found a bit of, in a creek, right? Had found a sort of oil film.
Exactly, and so they knew there was some, and they very shrewdly managed to hold on to this last realm of the territory, which they could not even see. And there was one other important caveat or one important element to the story, which is when they held on to the subsurface territory, they did it communally. And so after allotment, all the surface territory, or much of the surface territory, disappeared into the hands of whites, which is what happened to so many other American Indian nations. But each of the Osage on the tribal roll had what was called a head right, which was a share in this mineral trust. And a head right could not be bought or sold. And so they had become the world's first underground reservation.
And so we fast forward to 1921, which is when where the book opens and that passage that David read. And they're really, really wealthy.
Yes, fabulously wealthy, yes.
How much?
In 1923, in that year alone, there was about just a little more than 2,000 Osage on the tribal roll. They received collectively what would be worth today more than $400 million.
In a single year?
In a single year. They lived in, the public became transfixed with the Osage wealth because it belied longstanding stereotypes that traced all the way back to the brutal first contact with settlers. And so reporters, and I found these stories, and they're often told sensationally, filled with prejudice, but they would regale the readers with stories about the quote-unquote plutocratic Osage and the quote-unquote red millionaires who lived in these terracotta mansions. They had servants, many of whom were white, which caused all sorts of reactions among whites. It was said at the time, whereas one American might own a car, each Osage owned 11 of them.
But then they start dying.
Yes. They begin to die under very mysterious circumstances.
Under mysterious circumstances. And it's this sort of it's the unraveling of that, which is the heart of David's story. And I'm curious, I want to go back, take a step back now that we've kind of set the scene a little bit and understand a little bit of how you came to this story. How did you find it? I mean, was it someone had told you about it? I mean, at one point it was a famous story, but it certainly faded from memory, the collective memory.
Yeah. Yeah. So as a writer, I have a kind of a process of, I sometimes cold call people. If I learn there are people in interesting jobs or positions, I will cold call them and just chat with them. Sometimes they hang up on me. And occasionally they chat with me. I had read that the FBI had an internal historian. I thought, wow, that's so strange. I didn't know there was a historian inside the Bureau. The CIA has one too, but they won't speak to you. trust me, I tried. That's a true story. The FBI historian was very nice, and I spoke to him, and I just said, yeah, I'm a writer. I'm often just interested in history and interesting of any cases that you don't think have been written a lot about. We talked mostly about COINTELPRO, which for those of you who know, which was Bureau's illegal surveillance of left-wing groups primarily in the 70s, violated a lot of civil liberties. But at the very end of the conversation, he had mentioned the Osage case, but he didn't know much about it. And that, I actually, after that, spent a lot of time researching COINTELPRO, and I was like, oh, there's been a lot written about that. And then I looked back over my notes, and I saw this Osage thing, what is that? And so I just had like one sentence written about Osage, early FBI case, and I was like, oh. So I began to look, I couldn't really find much written about it. So I decided, but it sounded, when I heard about it, at least a couple details I could find online, kind of crazy. And so I said, well, I'll make a trip out to the Osage Nation. And I made a trip there, I think it was 2011, and I visited the Osage Nation Museum. And when I was there, I saw this great panoramic photograph on the wall. And for those of you who've read the book or have the book, the photograph's on the title page. And it was taken in 1924, shows white settlers along with members of the Osage Nation, and it looks very innocent. But I noticed that a portion of the photograph was missing. And I asked the museum director, a woman named Catherine Redcorn, who would later become a good friend of mine, I said, what had happened to it? And she said it had contained a figure so frightening she had removed it. She then pointed to that missing panel and she said the devil was standing right there. And she went down into the basement and she brought up an image of the missing panel. And there peering out very creepily from the corner was one of the killers of the Osage. And it's very rare that a story one tells has an origin story, but this really was the origin story for my project. It was at that moment when I said, I really would like to try to tell this story. And the reason was I kept thinking that the Osage had removed the photograph because they couldn't forget this part of their history. Mm-hmm. And yet people like me knew nothing about it. And so the project in many ways grew out of trying to understand who that devil was, but also trying to address my own ignorance.
And little did you know that you would spend the next 5 years?
Yes, had I known it was going to take 5 years, I might not have. my wife might have objected.
And so talk us through a little bit about how you began to kind of unravel this, because you started off with just this kind of sense of the FBI and this murder case, then you went there and you realized that there was a villain at the heart of it, a white man who had done something terrible to the Osage. And so talk us through a little bit about that kind of, you know, the beginning of the investigation. I think as we read the book, you know, we're part of that exploration, but it's also interesting to sort of understand a little bit how it happened for you as
yeah.
well.
So, I would say the first year after that visit, I decided I wanted to tell the story, but I still wasn't sure whether I could tell it, because it was a question of what material would be out there for me to actually tell the story. And so for the first year, I worked at the New Yorker. In fact, I think I worked on the Cuban story, if I'm not mistaken, about Olga and William Morgan. And during that period, though, I had sent FOIAs, Freedom of Information Acts, to every institution, FBI, Department of the Interior, Bureau of Indian Affairs, courts, prisons, Leavenworth. I had kind of created a diagram of individuals and where they had been to see what kind of records I could find.
So you had a sense then at that point of already who were some of the main players?
Yes, I started to put together a diagram of some of the main players. Now, it was kind of a vast homeland-like board that had a kind of semi-madness because there were so many people, and it was not organized. It was very bewildering in the beginning. And I also tried to track down descendants, so I wrote to descendants of people to see whether they might have letters or diaries or photographs. And during that first year, I mostly worked on the Yankee Comandante story, and every few weeks or a month, something would arrive. Sometimes it would just be an envelope with just saying, oh, we're so sorry, there was a flood in the sheriff's office in 1950 and we've got nothing. And then every once in a while, there'd be an envelope about that thick, and every once in a while, a box or two boxes would arrive. And I actually didn't look at them, I put them in the corner. And then after about a year, I decided, okay, let me take a look and see what I got here. Mm. And I began to go through it, and I thought, I think there's enough here. It was only about 10% of the research that would go into the story, into the book, but I thought there was enough there to give me leads. But the book, go ahead.
No, I'm curious, what was there a particular character or person who, as you began to read and understand who they were, that kind of made you think, I can write about her or him, I can do something here?
Yeah, well, there were certain individuals who became apparent. There was the devil, obviously, who is a central figure. There was Molly, who I wrote about, whose family is the prime target of this conspiracy. Her perspective was often neglected from official accounts. And I thought it was very important to try to record her perspective.
She was an Osage.
She was Osage, yes. She was Osage.
And 100% Osage?
100%, full blood.
Full blood.
Full blood Osage, yeah. And yet, you know, because she was Osage, her accounts were neglected at the time. But I was able to locate descendants. I was able to get oral histories. I was able to find testimony that she had given. A grand jury testimony that I was like, okay, I think I can try to do this. But I would say there were two, and this may be too boring and in the weeds, but there were two kind of elements that, one was I was overwhelmed by how to tell the story in the beginning. And there were just so many people and it spanned so many years. That I didn't have a way in. And then I thought of this way, accidentally, I was reading Faulkner's novel, Absalom, Absalom, in which he tells that story from the perspective of three individuals, and it has an oral history quality, almost an elliptic quality. And I was literally reading at night in my bed. It's a very hard novel to read. I had to read it twice to understand it. But I suddenly said, wait, I could tell the story from the point of view of three people. And that will let me narrow the story and focus it, and each had a perspective on the story. And collectively, hopefully, we could bring the story to light.
And you're one of the three people.
And I was one of the three people, because one of the things that happened, and that was not initially my plan, but one of the things that happened, when I began the book, I thought of it as a very conventional crime story, about a story about who did it, about this so-called devil. And that was the way the Bureau thought of the crime. But as I did more research in archives, as I spoke to more Osage, I began to realize that that was really a mistaken notion. That this was not a story about who did it, but who didn't do it, and about a much broader conspiracy, much darker conspiracy, in which evil lurked in the hearts of many seemingly ordinary citizens. And so to bring the story to the present and be able to tell that story, I needed a vehicle for that, which became my reporting in the third chronicle of the book.
And it works very well, as many of you know, about how, you know, in a way, that sense of discovery, the reader kind of goes through the same similar process that maybe you went through, and that you know, we start off with this character of Molly, this woman, and we learn about her and her tragedy, and it sort of seems pretty straightforward, and then it becomes more and more complicated with each section until we get to your section when you can kind of explain it all to us. And I guess, did you feel like you had to, the Osage never understood themselves the full extent of the conspiracy, or no one really did, right?
That's a good question. I think the Osage had a sense that it was broader.
Okay.
But the Bureau and the authorities never looked into many of these cases because so many of the victims. When I spoke to many Osage, they began to share with me stories. And the first hint or clue I had that it was broader was the woman at the museum, Catherine Redcorn. She said, when I first met her, we just literally met that time. She said, you know, at some point I'd like to talk to you about something. But she wasn't comfortable telling me. But I got to know her over time, and eventually she said to me, you know, there's a death in my family that was never investigated by the FBI. Mm. And it was my first hint that, wait a second, there are these other murders and suspicious deaths which weren't probed. And I'll give you just one quick illustrative story of that. I went to an archive in Fort Worth, Texas. It's an enormous place. It's a warehouse. It looks like something out of Raiders of the Lost Ark where they stick the Covenant at the end. It's enormous. I mean, it's just gigantic. It's like it looks like airplanes are coming in. And you're allowed these pulls. And I pulled records on what are called guardians. And because there was such prejudice against the Osage and they were scapegoated for their wealth, the U.S. government had gone so far as to pass legislation requiring many Osage to have white guardians to manage their wealth. A system that was not abstractly racist, but literally racist, was based on the quantum of Osage blood. So if you were a full-blooded Osage, you were deemed quote-unquote incompetent and given one of these guardians. Also created one of the largest state and federally sanctioned criminal enterprises as guardians began to swindle hundreds of millions of dollars. So I was pulling records.
But the guardians, you could have a, if you were married to a white, they could be your guardian.
They could be your guardian
for a wife,
the family.
For a husband. Or,
exactly, yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Which also led to...
Yes.
Corruption.
Exactly.
And murder, yeah.
Yeah. And when I was going, I pulled records on the guardians. And when you do research, there is a process of discovery. You don't know when you begin a project what the contours of it are or where it will lead you. And when I was looking through records of guardians, I wanted just to check whether a certain guardian person had who their guardian was. And so I pulled all these boxes on guardians. I was going through them, and I found this book. It looked like a log book. It was like a ledger. It looked like a business ledger. It had a fabric cover. And it was basically just a list of guardians for a span of years. And like I think it was like 1918 to 1921, something around there. And all it had was the name of a guardian. And then if it had an Osage whose fortune they managed, they referred to them as wards, it listed the names. The only other thing written in the book, though, was if an Osage had died, some anonymous bureaucrat had written next to their name the word dead. So I was looking in the book, and I was looking at the name of a guardian. And I saw that they had five Osage, again, I'll use the word wards just for clarity, because that was the term the government used. And I noticed that by the first Osage name, it had the word dead. Then I looked at the next Osage name, next to it said the word dead. Then I looked at the next Osage name, I said the word dead. I looked at the next Osage name, dead. All five dead.
In the 3-year period.
Yeah, just a few year period. I don't remember the precise.
Right.
It's in the
it's
book.
It's not like over 20 years.
Yeah, no. It defied any natural death rate. I said, that is crazy. And so I quickly, almost in this kind of, it took me a moment to realize, and then I was like, wait a sec, that's so strange. And then I began to look at some other names. And I saw one, again, it's in the book more precise than my memory, but I think somebody had about 12 Osage, and there was a 50%. 50% were listed as dead. I was like, this is nuts. And some of those deaths may have been from natural cause. It didn't specify, but it defied any natural death rate. I mean, the Osage had wealth. They had good health care. They had money. They were not poor or not hungry in the 20s. And I began to then look into some of those cases, and I began to find clues to murder, testimony, suspicions, money that was stolen. And I realized that this very, it was almost antiseptic book really contained the hints of a systematic murder campaign. And it really also got to the banality of evil, because I kept thinking of that damn bureaucrat who just kept writing in the word dead next to his names, clearly knowing what the hell was going on.
Yeah, I think that's, and I guess one of the things that's, which is sort of an underlying theme of what you're discussing in the book too, is where kind of the racism and the kind of institutionalized system, i.e. the government awarding these guardianships and wards and all that, versus the sort of just the individual greed and murderous intent of different individuals, and how these two sort of streams collide. And I'm curious sort of, because I think, you know, when you first start reading it, you think it's a matter of the devil and one or two other individuals who are maybe evil and murderous and greedy, and then you begin to realize that actually everyone was sort of in a way part of it, even whether they were actually killing someone or not, they were
complicit.
And yeah. You come away with a sense that hundreds, thousands of white neighbors, business people in this community were complicit in this.
100%. I mean, it really was a story about who didn't do it. I mean, in the sense that there were morticians who would cover up bullet wounds, you know, and shove the body into the ground. There were doctors who administered poisons. There were reporters who never disclosed what was going on. There were bankers and lawmen and politicians who were all getting wealthy, sometimes directly involved in the killings or profiting from them. And then there were many others who remain complicit in their silence. You know, when I began the book, I collected photographs, and I used photographs in the book in a way that I had never done, because I really saw the book as a work of documentation and chasing ghosts, trying to capture history as it vanishes. And early on, I would collect photographs of the victims, and I had a little office, and I initially had a photograph of some of Molly's family members. And then over time, the photographs grew. And by the end, I had a wall of photographs of various Osage victims as the story changed. But it really was about a culture of complicity. And you know, one of the things that struck me is there were so many oil men from that time period. People have asked me, were some of these famous oil barons, because so many of the people, oil barons whose names we know, made their fortune during this period.
Getty,
the Getty family, first struck oil in Osage territory. E.W. Marlin, the Phillips brothers from Conoco, Harry Sinclair. I mean, they would go and they would attend these auctions. And I never found any evidence connecting them to any of the crimes, those famous iconic figures. But I also never found any evidence of them speaking out. They were going regularly to attend these auctions in Osage territory, and everybody was making money. And again, it gets to that complicity of silence.
And I wonder if I imagine as you're writing this and you're thinking about this, and I'm sure everyone here in the audience wondering too, did you find any, and it's hard obviously 100 years later, but did you find any evidence or any understanding of kind of motive or how this sort of started, or was it just kind of built into the dehumanization of the Indians as lesser, and then also as in this sort of political system that allowed people to take advantage of them?
Yeah, I mean, I think there, you kind of hit them all. I mean, there were three factors, I think. If you ask me why were they were killed because of their money. I mean, these were thefts. And in terms of thefts, you need to understand the magnitude of them. This was not like knocking off a bank. If you were to steal this headright, which was your share in the mineral trust, you were given a quarterly check. So you were literally minting money every 4 months or every 3 months. Four times.
Yeah. 3 months, yeah.
I can't count. I can write, I can't
but they
count.
Couldn't.
No,
but they couldn't steal them exactly. I mean, it was even more insidious than that.
It was more insidious. These were intimate crimes because they were inheritance schemes ultimately.
And so good.
No, I was just going to say, but so they were killed. But the point you made, I think, is really important to underscore. racism was endemic to these crimes because the prevalence of them was because Native Americans and American Indians, the Osage, were not deemed with the same dignity of humanity and souls by so many of the perpetrators. And there was one quote which really struck home to me when I was doing my research, when you're trying to figure out. One of the henchmen in a bit of testimony said something to the effect of, you know, we don't see killing, and he used the word Indian, and, you know, we don't see killing an Indian any different today in Oklahoma, and this was the 1926 when he gave this statement, than in the 1700s. And so I think that those two forces were fueled together, and then tied into that force is they were able to get away with it. I mean, for years, and many of them got away with it. I mean, many of them escaped justice because the power structure was in their favor. And so authorities, white authorities, would investigate or were complicit or were racist. And so all those forces came together to lead to what really is one of the most sinister crimes in our history.
You're listening to the National Writers Series from Interlochen Public Radio. Coming up, David Grand talks about his book tour in the towns where the murders took place.
Listening to the National Writer Series from Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Doug Stanton, founder of the year-long book festival held in the historic City Opera House in Traverse City, Michigan. Let's return to Lucas Whitman's conversation with David Grand, author of The Lost City of Z and Killers of the Flower Moon.
I know when you were going around, you obviously spoke a lot with the heirs of grandchildren, great-grandchildren of people of the Osage who died. But I'm wondering, did you encounter any of the heirs of the whites who committed these crimes? And I'm curious, that's not part of the book, but I'm curious if that was sort of, if that's come out after the book.
So many of I interviewed descendants of both the murderers and the victims. Many of them still live in the same neighborhoods. Their fates intertwine, which is, I think, part of the story of America. And I asked an Osage elder, this isn't in the book, but I asked an Osage elder, what's it like knowing, you know, seeing the descendant, you know, just down the street of somebody whose ancestor participated in the killing of your family member? And she's, you know, we don't, they said, she's first, she said, they don't talk about it, either because they don't know or they don't want to. But she said, we don't hold them responsible for the blood of what their ancestors did, which I thought showed a great deal of compassion and under such circumstances. I interviewed many of the descendants of the murders. They were fairly forthcoming. I interviewed descendants of the devil. One of them expressed great remorse and sent me a note. It's not in the book, but after the book came out, sent me a note saying, if you ever see the Osage, please express our deep remorse for what we know they did. But just to give you a sense about how recent this history is and how this reckoning still takes place, I did an event in Tulsa after the book came out. It was very shortly after the book came out, Tulsa, Oklahoma. And just before the event, a woman came up to me and she said she was she was a niece of some way down of the devil. My first instinct was to recoil because I thought, okay, here it comes, I'm gonna get stoned. I mean, you know, it's not a very favorable portrait. And, you know, you just don't know what you're gonna find when you go out. You know, you've been holed up working on a project. But she didn't. She said she had heard some of the stories, and during the questioning Q&A period, she stood up. Now, you have to understand that in Tulsa, so many of the descendants of the victims were in that audience, including the granddaughter of Molly Burkhart, And she said something, she stood up and she said, you know, some of our ancestors did things that we're very ashamed of. We didn't do them, but we're ashamed. And she was a little bit cryptic, a little bit elliptical, but kind of made her point and sat down. I said, do you mind if I say who you are? She kind of nodded, she said, it's okay. And I said who she was. And at first it was just kind of a utter silence because there were a lot of Osage in that audience. But then afterwards she went up and she talked to Molly's granddaughter, and they actually embraced. But you could see how this history still reverberates to this day.
Well, it's two generations, right?
Yeah, it's not old.
It's not old.
I interviewed, most of it was two and third, but I interviewed a descendant who was alive at the time of the funerals as a little girl. One of the ways I was able to describe one of the funeral scenes, she was one of the only people I interviewed. She's sadly deceased now. She was about 100 when I interviewed her. But she remembered, she was there. She was a little girl. Hmm.
Incredible. And has the book, do you feel like it's, has it led to a kind of a reckoning and a kind of opening up of the community or
You know, it's hard for me to know that, to be honest, and I never try to, you know, it's hard to know. But I the one thing I said to the publisher when the book came out, you know, you spent 5 years on it, and I said, look, the only thing I'm going to ask you is you got to send me to Oklahoma, and you're going to send me to these little towns where I spent years doing research. And these towns are ghost towns. I mean, they have they're not in the publisher's interest. I mean, they have 200, 300, 400 people. They were great. The publisher said, we get it. We totally understand. So I went to Fairfax. I mentioned Fairfax, town of about 1,000. In fact, when I interviewed Molly's granddaughter, who grew up near there, her husband said to me, yeah, we had a parade once in town, but you know, there was no one to watch it because everyone was in it. But I went there, and I didn't know if anyone would come. You know, I mean, it's these towns all boarded up. But some people I knew wanted to have me there who had helped me with the book, some Osage. There's an old theater there which is boarded up, but they had been trying to renovate, and just the opening, they had opened up just the very inner part of it. You can't go past the entryway. And I appeared, and there was a line of hundreds of people. And Osage, who had come, brought relatives, and you know, for me, those experiences were, you know, incredibly moving. And I think I didn't ask the Osage why they spoke to me. As a reporter and a writer, you don't ask people why they speak to you. It's weird, but my feeling is that they had a sense that this history belongs in our national conscious. And while they were familiar with the story, they knew that the rest of the country had excised it from their conscious. And I do get the sense, I've done events, I was just back in Oklahoma, I did an event with descendants and the Osage chief. I think for them, it's important that this history is becoming part of our conscious.
And this has been a bestseller and is out there in the world in a major way, and so it's really out. That story is being told, as it hasn't. What happened? Why did it disappear from?
View? Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, I think there are two primary forces at work. One was Hoover early on. For those who read the book, they are able to resolve at least a small part of the case.
And J. Edgar Hoover.
J. Edgar Hoover. And he early on tried to use the case to kind of cement and self-mythologize his role. And of course, he never thanked any of the undercover operatives who worked on the case. And the only record I could find of anyone thanking the undercover operatives were the Osage, who issued a resolution thanking them by name. Hoover tried to take credit. But then other cases came along in the 30s, Dillinger, and that's when a lot of laws were passed that gave the Bureau far more expansive powers to make arrests, far more expansive jurisdictions over crimes. So it kind of faded from the Bureau's history. And then I think, you know, the same way the crimes were neglected in their day, I think a lot of the people who were telling history marginalized stories like this. or didn't hear about them. I mean, I never heard about this. I only heard about it by happenstance. Mm. It was never taught to me in school. And so I think these stories got marginalized from the broader conversation.
Yeah, I think also when we tell the story of what happened to the Native peoples of America, you know, often that's happening or seen to happen earlier than all this, right?
Yes.
This is something that happened in the 18th century, in the 19th century,
yes.
the kind of the creation of the West and all that, but not something that's still happening in the 20th century.
In the 20th. And the case really is a microcosm of all those forces playing out, but playing out very recently.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about the sort of middle part of the book is really, in addition to the investigation, it's really about also the sort of the FBI and what it was like. And I think one of the at least shocking things for me, and I don't know if others had this experience, was you know, how they were starting off. They were kind of ineffectual. They didn't quite know what they were doing in some cases. Hoover had this vision.
Yes.
And that was what was kind of propelling them forward. But there wasn't the sort of smooth operation. Well, maybe in the last year or two, we're changing our notion of that. But the notion that we've had in recent history of the FBI is this kind of, you know, very professional organization. You've got, you know, Tom White, who's this great character. And I'd love you to talk a little bit about sort of how it was uncovering the sort of the history of the FBI and how it was kind of forming itself as a professional organization.
Yeah. So, you know, the Bureau, you know, obviously in the news a lot today, was a really ragtag operation back then. Just had a smattering of agents across the country, a few field agents. They did not have jurisdiction over a lot of crimes back then. You know, they could deal with like smut being crossed state borders. If you escape from a federal prison, that fell under their jurisdiction. But they had jurisdiction over American Indian reservations, which is why this case fell to them and why it became one of the Bureau's first major homicide cases. But one of the things you discover, I'm not a specialist, so I'm a generalist in the sense that I find a story and then I will spend years researching it, but I don't often know that much about the subject matter beforehand. And I had no sense about how recent it was that we had so much problems in law enforcement in this country. I mean, a century ago, so many officers, sheriffs had such poor training, very little education, and corruption was widespread. I mean, it was very easy if you were powerful to tip the scales of justice. And the Bureau suffered from same problems. It had its own oil corruption scandal. And White, Tom White, who I write about in the book, in many ways the story is about the birth of America or a modern America. And Tom White is in many ways somebody who straddles two centuries. You know, he grew up on the frontier in a log cabin. His family came from, he was a bunch of lawmen. He had been a Texas Ranger. He had begun practicing law at a time when justice was meted out by the smoking barrel of a gun. And by the time when he's summoned by Hoover to take over the Osage case, you know, he has to wear a suit and a fedora. He's trying to learn modern techniques of law enforcement, which are now slowly being incorporated.
He couldn't carry a gun.
He did not have the authority to carry a gun. He didn't have the authority to make an arrest. If they wanted to arrest someone, they had to go to the local sheriff or the local police officer to do it. But he's learning fingerprinting, handwriting analysis became a part of this case. He has to file paperwork, which he can't stand. So the Bureau is slowly this emergence of a national police force. And I think, you know, this story has echoes of today in many ways. I don't think we all have bias for what we do, but I don't think you can, you know, as someone who writes about history, I don't think you can understand the present without history. And, you know, the notion of how do you have a national police force in this country? There had been a lot of resistance to it because of the, you know, going back to the, you know, to England and the colonial period, that somehow the secret police or state police. Mm-hmm. How do you have a national police force? How do you have one that's under a Justice Department, which is a political appointee, and not have it politicized? This has been a struggle that played out over this century. And how do you modernize and create this organization? And you could see the early seeds of that and the struggle to create that and kind of find its way. And as with most history, it has not been a smooth linear path. It's been like this.
Yeah, and they failed it. They sort of failed it at this period of time, and then again in the 70s. And
exactly.
And so it's interesting. I think it's an important point you make too, because I think sometimes when we talk about the present, we sometimes forget that we think that sort of things, again, have been improving, but in fact, you know.
No, the progress has come, and the Bureau is a far more modern professional organization. Hoover did bring a lot of elements of professionalism to the Bureau and training and the use of science. He also became an autocratic bureaucrat who abused his power to violate civil liberties and used it for his own power. You know, not to get off into too much on a tangent about the present, but I would just say many of the norms that we talk about today, like how long should the director be, they grew out of this period.
And a reaction to that period.
Yeah.
But Hoover's an interesting character because I think we all know him, I think, through various pop culture movies and all that. But he's in the book, he's someone he's, you know, in a way, like many of the characters, he's got sort of two sides to him. On the one hand, he is very interested in his own power and of changing the FBI, forming in his own image, of being kind of dictatorial and of kind of covering up maybe the larger extent of the crimes. But at the same time, he is someone who pushes hard to resolve this and to have an answer and to find out what's happening there in a way that no other, if it had been left to state law enforcement, never would have happened at all.
It's very true.
It's a sort of interesting.
Yeah, and I think, you know, it's funny, you get to see Hoover in a very early formative period, and same way you see the Bureau in a very formative period, and you see his bureaucratic genius. I mean, he really remade the Bureau into a more modern institution out of his force of his personality, and this case reflected that, of the beginning of the biggest transformation in law enforcement and the most important element in transforming law enforcement in America is the professionalization. And it's easy to forget that, which means that you follow certain rules of evidence, you're impartial, you have training, you're observant. These were things that were not prevalent, and it's easy to forget that. I often think we take for granted, we forget, we think things are always the way they were, and they really weren't.
And of course, as you've discovered in other reporting, that it's not always the case that law enforcement is always professional. There's a famous and very powerful story that David wrote about a Texas death row inmate who was convicted of killing his own children by an arson investigation by the evidence they put forward. And that's an interesting sort of, again, another example of obviously law enforcement getting it wrong.
Yeah. And gets some of the same themes. And one of the things that always interests me is the powers of observation and how we make sense of the world. The world is a very bewildering place, and we are all, in all of our own realms, investigators. Whether we're writers, whether we are professional detectives, we spend our lives trying to figure things out, even if it's just our own family, our own history. And this was a case where this fire broke out and these arson investigators came in, and we have this image of arson investigators from movies as these kind of Sherlockian people who see patterns, fire patterns. They look at the floor and they say, this fire was intentionally set at 7 p.m. on Tuesday. It turned out that 90% of it was total BS. Now, it wasn't intentional BS. It goes back to the lack of professionalization. Many of them were not trained, and goes back just 10 years ago, and even to this day, we're being modernized. They had just been told that from their previous arson investigator, who was told that by his previous, and it turned out that none of it was scientifically valid. I'll just give you one quick example that they came into that house, they looked on the wall and they saw something called crazed glass, which is this kind of pattern, like it looks like your shattered windshield on the car. And they said, they had been told that that meant that the house had excessive heating from some type of accelerant, like, you know, gas or something. Well, there was a forest fire out in California several years later, and a bunch of fire investigators went out there and they said, there's crazed glass, but this was just a natural fire. And only some of the houses have the crazed glass. I said, how can that be? So somebody said, it seems like the houses with the crazed glass are the ones where the fire hoses blew. It had nothing to do with excessive heating. It had to do with excessive cooling. And you can imagine, the cold hit the glass and it caused the spider out. They went into the lab and they did it. And they said, well, they totally disproved it. On and on. And so it's probably the clearest case this man was executed. It's probably the clearest case of an innocent man being executed in this country who was innocent. So professionalizing, being scientifically valid, how do we make sense of it? What are the biases? The person who was convicted was not he was someone who hit his wife. He wasn't, he was not your a choir boy. But it brought a lot of biases to the investigation. Tunnel vision locked in. So all those things I'm always deeply interested in, and how do we not produce outcomes like that?
And part of that is through reading books like yours and telling that history and investigating our stories and kind of understanding that history.
And even what's interesting about even a story like that is the resistance to acknowledging error. You know, I cover so many sins in life in writing books. One of the elements that struck me most in researching that story was how resistant we are to admitting error. And I kind of thought when the story came out and new evidence came out, the people who had made the errors would want to address them and kind of crusade about it. And instead they did just the opposite. And I found that even more dispiriting than the original decisions, because many of them were not intentional.
That's the way they had been trained that way, and they ended up through unintentionally putting someone to their death. We've talked a lot about the villains and stuff like that, but I'll talk a little bit more about, I think, Tom White, because I think, he's a hero, and I like the idea that, we all like the idea that there's a hero here as well. And I'm curious a little bit about, maybe you can talk a little bit about what kind of a man he was, and also how we're talking about professionalization, but actually in a way, it wasn't through professionalization, but sort of through his own careful investigation that he uncovered what had happened.
Yeah. So, the book is about the purest example of good and evil of anything I've ever done. There is genuine evil, but there's also goodness, quiet goodness, both in Mali, who and many other Osage, who very valiantly crusaded for justice when it put a bullseye on their back. I mean, here, like someone like Mali, for example, an Osage woman, her views were neglected because she was a woman and because she was Osage, and yet she crusaded for justice, she hired PI, she put out reward money, often in the face of great danger. And Tom White also has a real quiet goodness. When I was researching his story, I kept saying, there's gotta be some skeletons there. So I really spent a lot of time researching, and I didn't get that much into the book, but he later became a warden of Leavenworth. And I found a lot of the prison, people in prison had said very nice things about him. I said, well, that's interesting, the people in prison. And then at one point he's kidnapped. He's taken hostage during a prison escape, including by several Oklahoma outlaws. And he is shot and left to bleed out on the road. And he nearly dies. And I found an oral history given by one of those prisoners. And several of the prisoners, the other authorities were able to capture them, some of them killed themselves because they knew if you touched the warden in that day and you went back to prison, there weren't a lot of civil liberties. And so some of them killed themselves, but a few were caught, and this one was caught and went back. And in his oral history, he said the only reason we didn't get our heads knocked in was that White, when he was in the hospital dying, gave the order, he said, don't touch them. You put them in solitary, you don't touch them. Nobody lays a finger on them. He said it was the only reason. White survived, and I didn't go into this in the book, but in the oral history, he then became, after Tom had retired, he tracked down Tom White, and they became friends as old men. So here was the man who was part of a group that had tried to kill Tom White and left him to die, and they became friends. And he said Tom was the greatest, the most honorable man he had ever met. I said, well, I guess he's good.
Nice to, we're gonna draw our conversation to a close on that positive note there, I think, which we all need after, thank you, David. So. We're going to take some questions from all of you. And while there's going to be people with microphones coming around, I think someone in the back there has a question.
David, welcome to Michigan from Michigan Writers. I'm wondering, with all the writers that are in the audience, if you can say something about your transition from being a magazine writer to writing books and what you think the strengths were and what your challenges are with doing that.
Yeah, I would say, it's a good question. I mean, I think the hardest and the biggest transition is finding the right story to tell as a book. Because when you're doing a magazine story, the demands on the story and the reader's attention are lesser. And you can do stories that are larks because you're only going to spend a few months on them. I mean, I did a story about the hunt for the giant squid, which was a great deal of fun, going out in a typhoon with a half-mad New Zealand Ahabian captain. But I wouldn't want to do that for 5 years. So finding a story like this one where you feel like it has all these resonant themes and really in many ways is a story about the original contact, the original sin from which the country was born, the development of modern law enforcement, in many ways the birth of a modern nation. So for me, the hardest part is that. And then the things I really like about the book is that you can spend so much time and do it with a level of I don't want to say perfection because there's always imperfection, but you can spend enough time to really just keep digging and digging and deeping and spend enough time to keep rewriting all your bad writing.
Not too much of that with you, David, I'm sure. We've got time for one more question here. Yes.
Thank you for coming tonight. I couldn't help but put in a question about The Lost City of Z. I really enjoyed that book too.
Thank you.
Has there been any information that has come forward since you published the book that you have found credible about the fate of Percy Fawcett and his companions?
Not in terms of his fate, but there has been an enormous amount of new discoveries about ancient settlements in the Amazon, including these massive earthworks. They look almost from the sky as if they've been kind of carved into the earth. And so the discovery of these settlements and these very sophisticated civilizations are left behind these remains. And those are continuing to transform our understanding of what the Americas looked like before the arrival of Christopher Columbus and really exploding our perceptions. And we are really only at the beginning of that archaeological revolution of understanding the breadth of these civilizations, how they lived, and there are still more discoveries happening. So on that front, there's still been a great deal.
Thank you very much, David. Thank you all for being a great
Thank
audience
you
tonight.
All.
David
Thank
Graham.
Thank you, Lucas.
That was David Gran talking with Lucas Whitman. David Gran's latest book is Killers of the Flower Moon. Learn more about the National Writers Series and upcoming events at nationalwritersseries.org and listen to past programs at interlochenpublicradio.org. For Interlochen Public Radio, I'm Linnea Melcarrick.